Also, by the way, when we say street children in India, it's not street children as understood in the Western world. They're not kids that spend a lot of time on the road. These kids sleep on the street, on the pavement, every single night. They wake up there. They cook, if they cook, there. They eat there. They work there. It's 24/7 without interruption on the street. So there's no baths. Unless you swim in the sea, if you're in a city like Bombay, you just go to the sea, jump in, and get out. So that's life.
Welcome to Justice Matters, the podcast inspiring a world where everyone belongs. I'm your host, Tim Buxton. Today we have on the show the founder of the charity that serves street children in India called Good Shepherd Homes. His name is Jared, and I had the privilege of meeting Jared in the early 2000s here in Australia, and then I went and visited their work several times just outside of Mumbai, India, in a place called Telangana, and I had the privilege of visiting their work, seeing the incredible impact they will have bringing children off of the streets, putting them in a home, giving them an education, transforming their lives. Jared, like I said, has been a good friend. He was one of my groomsmen, and it's such a privilege to be able to share this catch-up that I had with him just yesterday. We recorded this podcast, and I'm just so thankful for Jared's incredible perseverance over the years leading this work. It is certainly no easy task. And as we delve in and talk about some of the real challenges in this whole area of homeless children, street children, in places like India, but really all around the world, I think your kind of eyes will be opened up to the inner workings of how this terrible injustice exists in our society, but also the incredible path forward and how to actually bring systemic change and hope to these children's lives. I hope you enjoy this interview that I have with Jared. Here it is.
I went over in the mid-90s, and me and some friends, we started an agency, a charity, to give kids the chance to get off the street. There are many good organizations that work with children on the street, too. Providing educational tools, providing blankets and, you know, a few survival skills. But my feeling has been over years that if a child remains on the street, they're still going to be drug addicted at the end of the day. They're still going to be infected with various viruses, and there's no feasible future. You're not going to get a job, you know. You're not going to get any kind of security in the long run. So the best, and some people contest it, but I feel very much the best way is into some kind of a house environment, home environment, and into an education that is sort of a regular drag, like most of us have been through, right? School. We call it school.
Well, I love you've kind of brought up a couple of key points in what you do, and maybe we can delve into those in more detail later on, the whole importance of education, yeah. Of having a home, and being cared for in a home environment. What I would love to kind of tease out from you is really how it began. I mean, I remember meeting you for the first time. You picked me up. You picked us up actually, I met you first in Australia, and then I got the privilege of going to India to see your work, and you picked us up in Mumbai Airport,
right,
and
right,
took us on that rickety, winding drive in the middle of the night up to Pune. And I think your place at the time, yeah, was in Telangana, a bit outside of Pune there in the countryside.
Yeah.
So, but you did that same journey yourself, just by yourself. You went to India,
mm-hmm,
and you had a few rupees in your pocket, And who would have thought that today you'd have a multi-complex of homes and a school and incredible staff running an organization you should, I'm sure you should be really proud of.
It's been a long time coming. It's been a long time coming. So I went over just because I had an interest. And so I set out, bought a plane ticket. It's as simple as that. And I had, you know, a couple of hundred quid on me. And boom, you're in India. At that point in the 90s, it was really a different world. Today, I think India is cleaned up a little bit. You know, the odd thing, I don't know whether you know this, but when Slumdog Millionaire came out, it was a huge hit and it was an Oscar winner. But for the Indian government, it was bad news. They took it to be bad news. They took it to be a national embarrassment.
Right.
And so they started this huge cleanup operation, get these kids off the street. So now kids are being rounded up much more regularly by police forces, by even the people that are working with the police, plainclothes cops, and they get put into remand homes. I don't think that in your time in India you went past a remand
home. No, I don't remember.
The remand homes are essentially youth prisons, right? So these young kids, 7, 8, 5, 6, 9, 10, whatever age that they get picked up, they get put into one of those, and it's rough, terrible, terrible place. I've been in them, and they are Dickensian conditions.
Wow,
you know, it still goes on, unfortunately.
Yeah. So when you came back, things were a lot different in the 90s. You saw quite a, I can imagine there was quite a lot, like you mentioned, of street children everywhere. What impacted you the most? What kind of made you think, well, this is something that I can do something about? I need to do something about this.
Yeah. Well, whether you go out on Main Street or whether you're, for instance, in a train station, wherever you find yourself, the kids are there and they'll be pulling maybe on your trouser legs and kind of tap you on the back and trying to get your attention. Did you experience any of that when you were in India?
Oh, sure. I mean, almost they are masters of getting into your... weaseling their way into your car window, onto your, wherever it is that you might be, into your space. Some of them quite cute too. They use every trick in the book, every charm.
No, that's what they live on, right? Is their wits, their charm, their skills. It's even a kid of 8, 7, 8 can pick up a mouthful of English and manage, you know. But what I found is that it's relatively easy to start to make a difference. It's not so hard to give a child a chance. What we had to do as a brand new organization was a couple of things in order to start making a tangible difference. Number one, we had to get ourselves organized, registered. Number two, we had to go and find children where they were that were willing to leave the road, start in school, and enter into their own journey toward a bit of a life. So finding kids was not hard. The kids, they are, like I said, everywhere. Third thing was that obviously street kids don't have birth certificates.
Okay.
They don't have paperwork. They've got one pair of pants, they've got one t-shirt, they're ready to go. This is their work and their living. Also, by the way, when we say street children in India, it's not street children as understood in the Western world. They're not kids that spend a lot of time on the road. These kids sleep on the street, on the pavement, every single night. They wake up there. They cook, if they cook, there. They eat there. They work there. It's 24/7 without interruption on the street. So there's no baths. Unless you swim in the sea, if you're in a city like Bombay, you just go to the sea, jump in, and get out. So that's life. We got to know as a team very quickly. We got to know a number of them. Got to know 10, 15 kids. And many of those children, they really do not want to be there. They're there because they've run away from domestic violence. They've escaped danger. Families have fallen apart. Drug-related situations. Parents are either on brown sugar, which is sort of a corrupted form of heroin, or they're alcohol addicted. They've maybe come from Bihar. Within 24 hours, they're on VT station. They're sleeping in the station with all of the kids by their side. But three, say, weeks down the road, maybe the parents have found a slum dwelling. And a slum dwelling is like a corrugated iron shack. And it's 15 square foot. And the kids are there with them. There's one big bed. But what happens is a month later, as tensions rise and despair, you know, kicks up, kids scatter because they're not eating. There's no life to be lived. And so that's how children turn into street kids. And they end up, like I said, on the road without a birth certificate. So they don't even have a means if they wanted to get into the school system. They can't get admitted. You need a school bag, one. You need a school uniform, two. You need a piece of paper. You don't have any of those things, right? So how are they going to get from A to B? What we had to do, and in those days, that's not even valid anymore, but in those days, what we did was we would go into the local hospital, in a government hospital. And you go into the government hospital with the child, and one of the consultants, one of the doctors, will look the kid in the teeth, and they'll say, well, she is definitely seven.
Wow.
No doubt, you know, either seven or eight, but we're going to say seven. What date is the child born? Well, do you have any preference? So you pick a date arbitrarily, and 5 minutes later, you've got a birth certificate. A backdated birth certificate. This child was born, and well, most likely you're within a year of the actual birthday. So we did that for all of those children. And lo and behold, they've got everything that they need to then start their legal citizen journey. Right?
Induction into society.
That's it. You know, they're all of a sudden, they're in society, not in their head. But physically they are.
Right. On paper, you know, they are.
So many times, example, we would be with kids in the local train, going maybe to the zoo or going to, you know, going to see a movie or something like that. And you get into the local train. Local trains are packed in India. And you've got people just flock to trains because they're cheap and they're fast.
Yeah.
Roads are congested, so trains are the solution. And our kids invariably would just squat on the ground in the dirt because they have learned from infancy that that is their place. And without question, if somebody will come in, especially if they're sitting down somewhere, they will immediately just go down, sit on the ground, and they wouldn't even be aware. So to even see that, you know, and have the ability or the privilege to communicate with a child that they are now a citizen of this country. And they have every right to sit on a chair or to sit on a bench. It's like a revelation to an 8 or 9 year old. They didn't think that they would ever get there in their whole lifetime. So the caste system, quote unquote, has been canceled, but the social ramifications of it, just like a chicken whose head has been cut off, right? That chicken, it can still run for a mile. Some chickens have been known to live for days, right, without a head. And the caste system has lived without a head, a legal head, for decades now. It still goes on
now
today.
Now, I remember when I was first there, and the children knocking on your door or window at a traffic light. You mentioned on the trains, there'd be dozens and dozens of street kids just walking up and down the trains, begging. It was everywhere, at least when I was there. And of course, you referred to the attempt to try and minimize this apparent, blight on society, on Indian society. You alluded to the caste system. Is there a reason? Can we go into why it's such an issue, in particularly in India? I mean, there's a lot of other poorer, less developed countries that don't have this issue, and very populous countries as well. Is there something within that systemically a part of that culture that gave rise to it?
Sure. I think one of the main problems is, and you find street children in these mega cities. Bombay is 22 million people, right? Delhi is 19 million people. Pune, when I came to it, was 3.5. But that's 20 years ago. And today it's 7 million. That's 7 million people in a region. And Pune.
Yeah.
That's a regional town. Okay.
Goodness.
But it's now become the size of London. Bombay, the population of Bombay fits in to 1/3 of the geographical area that London occupies. So you have 10 times the population concentration of London. And you can tell there's no space. There's absolutely no space. So when families arrive, there are no houses for them to file into. There are slum dwellings, but they very often have to be physically built. You have to build, you have to compile your own slum before you move into it, right? So that means get a wall, somehow attach it, get a piece of plastic, put that over your head. Have a pan, have a burner, have a mat, there's your house. So it's completely unsustainable. These cities are bursting at the seams.
Wow.
So take that situation for one.
Yeah.
Secondly, you have this idea in many of the rural areas, and still today, 40% of India lives in the countryside.
Yeah.
And many of these people cannot read and cannot write. They're illiterate farmers. They might be able to read a couple of words, but they're not conversant with any written content. So the idea is, when we go to Bangalore, when we go to Hyderabad, the money is there. Look at Bollywood, you know, look at the stars. The streets might not be paved with gold, but they're going to be paved with something more than what we've got over here, sure. Right? So there's an incredible sense of promise and potential. So families bundle up. They get on the train. They take what they've got. We're going to the city. They end up there, and they find out they got there that morning with 2,000 other people. Mm. I'm not exaggerating. Wow. You know, they also got off the train with nowhere to go. So it doesn't take very long for people to start losing hope. And now add to that issues of then alcoholism, substance abuse. For the younger generation, it's solvents and glue that they get very quickly hooked on, because there's dealers on the street that are very proactive and try to hook kids. And the drugs are cheap, but they're expensive for them. The drugs might only be 7 rupees. They might be like cents, you know, pennies. But so within a couple of weeks, the kids are hooked. Parents are hooked on something because they're depressed and they're fighting and blaming each other, right? And so this sort of domestic despair plays out over and over and over again. Mm. Other thing is that now, it's not so much now, but HIV was a huge issue.
Yeah.
And so then you've got a generation of parents that are dying with these viruses, with these adjacent conditions, or it's other things like typhoid or TB or, you know, whatever, cholera. And so then the kids get orphaned. They just end up orphaned, or there's one parent that cannot cope.
Yeah.
And hello. Next week, the child is on the road. They become a street child.
Let me tell you about one of our partners, Freedom Broadband. They're an incredible profit for purpose business. Freedom Broadband is your all-in-one internet and telephone service provider, whether it's for your business or your home. Now, their internet connection and speeds are simply amazing, and they're in another league when it comes to the quality of their customer service. But here's what really sets them apart. When you switch to any of their services, they'll donate $5 every month to a nonprofit cause of your choice. As the founder of You Belong, an Australian-based nonprofit charity, one of the greatest challenges we face is fundraising. And I think I can speak for almost all leaders in the nonprofit world when I say that being able to have a residual income coming into your accounts to support your work is a dream come true. And like most nonprofits, our work is dependent on the generous support of individuals and groups that share our passion to empower refugees to integrate and thrive here in Australia. What that means is that we spend more time and energy looking for ways to raise support. And what I desperately love to be doing is spending that time and our limited resources developing and growing the many successful programs that we run. But here's where our friends at Freedom Broadband come in. You see, a few months back, I was on a 4G wireless connection at home through one of the largest phone and internet companies here in Australia. And each month I was nervous about going over our usage, getting a nasty bill at the end, and I was working on a lot of the podcasting and videos at home, and the speeds I was getting were just painfully debilitating. And I finally decided to give Freedom Broadband a call. And within 2 minutes, I was on the call with Graham completing my application. And within a week, I had completely switched over to their $79 a month unlimited plan. And I can tell you firsthand, the service has been phenomenal. And I have a direct line to their customer service team whenever I have a question or need assistance. Now the studio and office where I work has switched over to Freedom Broadband as well. We're on their business plan and we haven't looked back. And how cool is this? Little by little, connection by connection, Aussie owned and locally run Freedom Broadband is now actively supporting the great work of nonprofits in communities all around Australia. Simply by switching your internet to Freedom Broadband, you can help transform the lives of those less fortunate. And that's why I love these guys. And get this, head to freedombroadband.com.au and quote Justice Matters on your application form, and they will donate $50 from the activation fee to support Justice Matters. That's going to enable us to continue this podcast and inspire the world where everyone belongs. That's freedombroadband.com.au. Say goodbye to expensive, mediocre internet with poor customer service, and hello to top-notch internet service and the good feeling of knowing you're supporting a great cause. Join Freedom Broadband today. Quote Justice Matters, and let's partner together with the internet that's helping to change the world. And it seems like that street child, street kid industry is a very well-oiled machine these days that they can suddenly quickly and swiftly get caught up into. What I'm hearing is this sense of one, just overpopulation, population density, just poverty in general, and that could be from the remnants of a caste system that you were referring to that kind of almost legitimizes poverty and says it's a, you know, this is your place, and
yes.
And so you've got overwhelming poverty, especially in rural places, and in an unequal distribution of wealth, overpopulation,
yes,
and, you know, highly vulnerable family dynamics that then feed into this system that exists. And so is that somewhat a summation
of really
what you're saying? And so given that that's the case, and India today has developed as an economy, there has been a growth in many respects. I mean, I remember the first time I went there, Mumbai, you know, there were buildings going up. The second time, it was like barely recognizable. It was like like whole new cities within cities were had been built, and that was back in 2010, 2008, I don't know.
Yeah, even before that, I think it's 2005, maybe 6. You were last, something like that. I can't remember when you were last there. But
so 15 years ago, right. I don't even know what I'm talking about now.
When you look at KL, or you look at Shanghai, Shenzhen, Shanghai, all these places.
Yeah,
you know, these Asian mega cities, fiberglass, right, upon fiberglass and steel. You see that sort of prefab city rising up out of nowhere on top of the crumbling old Mumbai, right? So there's two cities in one.
Wow.
And the old city is still prevailing, and the new city is full of desks and offices. Mm. And the other city is by and large where people live. And people also live in high rise. You know, the residential blocks are going 30 floors, 35 floors high.
Wow.
And so many of the slum dwellers now get rehoused into cheaper versions of these residential communities. Mm. Much of Mumbai now lives in gated communities with your watchmen and, you know, with the padlocks and everything like that. And
so still highly segregated in so many ways.
Oh, totally yeah. segregated. Yeah. But, you know, they've built economy versions. What they build project blocks, right? Like for the American viewers, right?
Sure.
And so what happens a lot is that slum dwellers then get, number one, their whatever they live in gets razed to the ground.
Mm.
So your house is gone, and I've been there when it happens.
Wow.
So you've got a bulldozer in the street. They are going from one end to the other, and they're razing, flattening the whole place. Mm. And very often there's a commercial aspect and there's a residential aspect to the slum. People are selling stuff. People are putting up a little barbershop. The whole thing is gone down. That family then, they start to rebuild that slum. They take it very stoically when it happens. Mm. They start to rebuild that slum from the minute that it's down, even before the cops leave the premises, leave the neighborhood. They're gathering whatever's been cast off. By the evening, most likely that slum in some form or other is standing again. Mm. Right? So people get pointed to kind of a concrete box. This is now your house. We've built this for you. And so they will rent that out to someone, slum dwellers. They're now owners of that space. They will still live in the slum, but they'll rent out the space that they should live in to somebody else for additional income. Wow. Right? Yeah. And so the slums are still there. Up to recently, 42 or so percent of Bombay residents were living in slums. So you're talking about a significant portion.
Almost a half of the population. Yeah. Now, so however you slice and dice it, whether they do choose to move into their new concrete slum box or not, you're dedicated and your team is dedicated to going after, for want of a better phrase, going after those that are at the very bottom of that scrap heap, that have little to no hope. And I want to talk about your approach in this, because there's a lot, like you said, there's a lot of organizations doing a lot of good things, but you've kind of taken this specific approach. One, you took an approach to put them in houses and give them house parents, which I think is
a lot
different to, you know, a big center with where it's a traditional orphanage approach. Secondly, you prioritized education, and you've now even got your own school that you're educating them, and not necessarily, you're able to have even more impact and input into their lives than just the time that they're at home. So can you talk about maybe those two areas? Because, you know, there's obviously probably even so many other things that you're doing helpful. Sure.
Yeah.
And why?
Yeah. Well, when I went out there, I obviously did my homework. So I just started to, it was no bright idea on my part. I started to liaise with different organizations that have been out there for a number of years. They're doing this, coming and going. And so with children's homes, dormitories don't really work. The reason, of course, that they don't work is that kids get forgotten. There's always a pack mentality when children get in large groups. So you want to keep those groups as small as possible. We would love to have units of 7 children. We don't. We have units of 10, 12 kids. But if even the staff child ratio goes up more, it for an organization like us, it becomes untenable, unsustainable. But hey, we've got 2 staff members for a group of 10, 11 kids. They live like a family, like a normal, basically mom and dad and kids, as much as possible. And our staff don't work in shifts. They live with the kids like any set of parents lives with their kids. Sometimes our house parents have had their own children on top, so maybe they've got 1 or 2 kids. And they've got their group of either boys or girls. You can't have mixed in India. It has to be one gender only.
Okay.
That's a long story in itself. But so you want to preserve an intimacy and an environment where every child is noticed, every child is important.
Mm.
And as you said, the other thing is schools. Now, when we first started, we just placed our kids in different schools. Some are ready for English, what they call in India, English medium school, and others were in Hindi schools. A couple of years ago, we started our own school. And so the kids that we admit, we can tailor our education to their specific needs. Mm. And every child comes in with their own story. Some have issues because they've got, you know, X amount of trauma on the back burner puttering away.
Yeah, I mean, remember,
so
I remember
you find
we
that
talking.
Some kids, they take 2-3 years before their active mind really kicks in. So, you know, many times you've got to work with them, extra tuitions, maybe a little bit of therapy. It's different with every child.
Yeah. I remember when we were talking actually the other night and we were, just thinking about, you know, what we could really address in this specific episode, and what came up for me as we talked was this idea of you've got a child that at as early as 3 years of age their operating system is survival, and they have learnt how to get by in a very hostile environment.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. when even with a loving family, a supportive environment around them, it's going to take a lot of time for that programming and that modus operandum to change for them to get to a place where they're able to even learn in a school, to even think that that there is anything beyond, you know, how do I just make it through this day? What do I need to do?
Yep.
So, yeah, I can only imagine the need for patience and such a,
a
commitment to walking through with that child. Can you think of a story comes to mind, maybe
that really
kind of brings that maybe truth home?
Yeah.
Impact of
Well, you know what? Living with rejection is rough. It's really hard. And children invariably internalize discrimination that they encounter to mean that their value is somehow less. They may not verbalize that internally, but that is the message that they decode from what they hear and see. You're nothing. You're in the way. And that's the message that's constantly reinforced. So there was one time when in the beginning, when I walked into a shop in Punjab, right in the heart, in the bowels of old Pune, and it was a bread shop. I was waiting in line, and it seems like the line wasn't very long, but I was waiting in line for like a long time. And when it was my turn, somebody else was called up in front of me. And then, I got it, you know. You're white, you're English, we're sending you a message that you can wait. And somebody, you know, because there's resentment there. There is whatever. I never had a conversation with that shopkeeper. But even for myself in my position, and this was so trivial. Mm. It was unimportant. I get served 3-4 minutes later than otherwise I would have. Is that going to affect my life? Is it going to affect my day? No, but it affected me inside. Mm. I was offended that I was bearing, you know, the cost for what another generation had done. Now, I'm experiencing that as an adult, being unfamiliar with it. Mm. But children that are growing up with rejection every single day, to them, it's fully internalized. So by the time that child is 6, 7, 8, they feel that they've got it coming. They feel that they are deserved. They feel that they are what they've heard that they are. Mm. Right? So I was once in Bombay going down the stairs in the station, in Bandra Station. Okay, I'm going down the stairs, and there was a boy sitting there. He was about 7 years of age. He was a beggar. He was sitting on the stairs, and I stopped, and I wanted to give him a 5-rupee coin, and a guy, just a commuter, came up from the other direction, walking up the stairs, and stopped me, and he said to me, "I know it sounds harsh. Maybe you won't believe what he thought I'm a tourist. I got there last week, right?" Yeah. That's the assumption. He said, "I've been there for 10 years. And so he said, "You're not going to believe maybe what I'm saying, but he's a professional." That's a professional beggar, that boy is, right? So even the citizens of the big cities are victims in that sense, because a message has been reinforced to them that this situation is systemic, this is a permanent, this is a blight, for lack of a better word, on society. Street children have always been there. They will always be there. I once saw a girl. She could not have been more than maybe 4 or 5 years of age. And she was sitting outside of the exit of Victoria Terminus Station. That's that large, that elephantine, like King's Cross Station in South Bombay. And she was sitting there by herself in a little red dress, right? Mm. Little girl sitting begging, and she is doing that every day. Mm. Now, I only noticed because we were making, at that point, a documentary on a few kids that we were about to take into the home. But not one person would stop and ask her, "Why are you here? What are you doing? What's your situation?" They're not, the people that don't stop are not bad people.
Yeah.
You know, their standard of hospitality is on a much higher level than my standard was growing up in Holland. These are people that are fully functional, compassionate. Mm. They're givers. They live for their friends and their family and for their community. They are responsible citizens. But a street child is a street child.
Right.
And so these things have kind of, they have become so, they've become so customized that they now have become, by and large, not completely, not by everyone, but by the majority, they're unchallenged.
Yeah.
And so these conditions, they perpetuate from generation to generation. A 15-year-old now is used to seeing a whole bunch of kids on the street, and it's not even questioned because they've always been there.
Sure. You know?
They were there in 1895.
I would say any systemic issue or problem within any society, those that are in it will rarely notice that it's actually an issue. It's because it's so familiar and so part of everyday life. Now, I'd love for you to kind of follow some of those examples up with maybe a story of one of the kids you've brought in and the transformation and change that you saw. And I think people want to know that there's still hope and it's still worth being, you know, putting yourself out there. It's, you know, committing to this kind of work. I'd love for you to share maybe one of the stories of your own kids.
Yeah. I would love to. Right at the start, when we began the first home, we took the members of, we admitted four kids from the same family. The mother had died in a truck accident. The father was an alcoholic. And there was just no way for the kids to get their needs met, basically. Mm. Now, we've never been in the habit of pulling families apart or in the habit, in the practice. If there is a way for the natural mother or the natural father to make the situation work, then by all means, that has to be the solution, right? It's only when there really is no other way. But the kids, they come in, this particular family, they came in, and the oldest boy, I'm going to call him Santosh. That's not his real name, okay? So Santosh, he joined in 1996, and there was one night, this was not myself, but this was one of my colleagues. One night, Binu was doing the rounds in the bedrooms and was looking around, seeing if all the kids are okay. And so suddenly, this boy woke up, and he sat up in bed with an open knife in his hand, right? And eyes wide, knife drawn. This is just in the bedroom.
Oh, right? My.
So he just asked Santosh, what's going on? What's the matter? And the boy said, I just woke up. Not a problem. So as we dug a little deeper in the situation, we found out that he slept with a knife every single night under his pillow. Mm. When we started to ask why he slept with a knife under his pillow, it was because they had talked together and had decided that they should stay on guard because you just never know what's going to happen.
Wow.
When they were four, somebody had come drag one of their friends off at night.
Oh, my.
Their blankets got stolen. One of the kids got beaten up by a cop in the middle of the night. So you're always armed and you're always ready. Yeah. Even when you go to a facility like ours and you're living in a normal neighborhood in a domestic situation and you're going to school, you've got your school bag, you've got your uniform, you've got your teacher, and everything has been stable for like 2 years, right? Those kids were still in the frame of mind where they thought, you know, what if we're going to get traded off? What if we're going to get trafficked and put on a boat? What if we're going to end up in a jute bag at night and we're going to be carted off to the harbor and put in a ship and we get sold in England as child slaves? Those were the ideas that some of their friends on the street had fed them. And so that all of that insecurity was still, you know, puttering away in the background. But you know what? With patience and with consistency,
yeah,
that That guy today, he's got two children. He's an overseer in his business.
Oh my goodness.
He's become a success. And we have stories in that way of, I don't know, just more than I can count. You know, one of our kids went to Hyderabad and went through nursing school and then became a nursing overseer in their hospital.
Oh, my goodness.
Another one became a user interface designer and finally got into an international banking corporation and is now in the design of the banking interfaces that we are facing on our computers when we do our online banking.
Amazing.
You know, another kid went in, has become, came from the north of India. Both parents died with HIV, sibling died with HIV. And today, she's a medical doctor in Pune. And got a qualifications about 3 years back and has been operating as a GP. So, yeah, even, you know, this is the hope. Even though many of the prejudices are still in place, and none of us, by the way, are exempt from prejudices. Mm. We just have blind spots.
Yeah, exactly.
It is possible for children to climb the ladder, walk the road, progress, because in today's India, skills are valued. Mm. Work ethic is valued even above maybe your physical background, right? Mm. Or where you come from or where you don't come from. And so that's been an enormously encouraging thing to see that you can hop on, quote unquote, the system and make a success of yourself in 21st century India. It's the best news ever.
Yeah. I was going to kind of finish off by asking you, what is your hope? And I think you just summed it up. This is the hope, that if you can provide these children, these precious children, and if you, one, see them with dignity and you see the potential that they have and not see them as what they are and what they are viewed by society, because what they are is beautiful souls with potential. If you can provide a loving home, and if you can give them an opportunity to discover their gifts, their skills, mm-hmm. to get an education, then anything is possible. And that's what you guys are doing. And it's worth it when you can just tell those stories and countless more that we simply just don't have time for. I mean, that is what is so inspiring about your work. And I will say what is inspiring to me personally, Jared, I've known you for a long time. Yeah, how long? Let's do the number. It's almost
18 years. 17, 18 years.
Yeah, so I've known you for that long. Like that. You were one of my groomsmen at my wedding. Your faithfulness.
Yeah.
You split your time between India and overseeing the work on the ground and traveling all around Europe and elsewhere just to ensure that this work can continue, to that there's food on the table for these kids, that there's salaries for the staff, that there's a home for these children to live in and a school for them to go to. Jared, thank you for your faithfulness. Thank you for not giving up on them. And I know you would easily deflect that.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of time and consistency to see that through.
It's a privilege. And of course, it feels like when you start somewhere like this, it feels like you're giving up. But then you find out that you're taken up. To have a front seat in the play of human transformation and to see – a person's health come around, their physical health come around, and to see their confidence emerge. Once you get to know people, it's a matter of discovery that their life is as large, as intense, as valuable as your own. It sounds like a no-brainer, but these sometimes are the things that we don't actually add up. So when there is relationship, there is that discovery that, yeah, here is a potential of a life larger than my own. So when you then are in a position to give a person, and I don't say a child, but a person, there is an adult hiding in there, right? You give a person the tools to work toward their own life and to build their future, you've multiplied your life.
Yeah.
You've doubled your life. Let's say that you reach 3 children, you reach 5 children, you reach 10, you reach 25 or 50. And that's worth crawling through glass for. But it's not been a task. It's been an absolute joy. It was a joy. It's been a joy from day one. And it's still a joy today.
Jared, how can people learn more about your work? How can they, if they were listening to this and they're moved and they're like, I would love to be a part of this, how can they learn more? How can they be a part of what you are doing in India?
Sure. That's easy. We are on goodshepherdhomes.org. So that's good, G-O-O-D, shepherd, S-H-E-P-H-E-R-D, homes, plural, goodshepherdhomes.org. And there you can read a little bit more about the work that we do, what we're up to, what our projects are, how people can get involved, etc.
Awesome. And you're on Facebook as well, I believe, and even Instagram.
We're on Facebook also. When people search Good Shepherd Homes, Good Shepherd Homes Pune, we're easy to find.
Yeah. Well, I would encourage anybody listening, if you've got a prompt or you've been inspired by what you've heard, definitely head over to those places. They'll be in the show notes for you to listen to. Is there any other final remarks, Jared? Anything else that you would like to say? Thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate just sitting down, delving into this issue, unpacking it and as an issue, but also just hearing about just the incredible work that's happening.
Sure. No, I would just say it's always a joy, Tim, to speak and catch up. Thanks for having me, and looking forward to the next time.
Yeah, you got it. All righty, Jared, thanks a lot. We'll speak again soon, no doubt. Thanks for listening to this episode of Justice Matters. I'd like to take this time to thank my audio-visual engineer, Jose Biotto, for your help in producing the show. I'd also like to shout out to the Patreon community that financially supports this podcast. Guys, thank you so much for your support. You can join them simply by going to patreon.com/justicematters for a simple donation of $5 a month. You can become a part of the Patreon community and get access to behind-the-scenes content and extras that I share just with you. And lastly, there is another really important way that you can help support the podcast, and that's simply by rating it or leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, maybe by subscribing on YouTube. Yes, we are a video podcast as well. Guys, thank you so much for listening in to this episode of Justice Matters. Please come again soon. I can't wait to share more episodes with you. I'm your host, Tim Buxton. Thanks for listening.